Accession number 4586, room number 4.
Air Commodore Sutcliffe, Reel 4.
Were you conscious of the expansion of the RAF at this time in the late 30s?
Yes, I think around about 1937 the expansion really started. It carried on through 1938, and when the Munich crisis was occurring, it was still carrying on. But what happened was there weren't enough relatively senior officers of the rank of flight attendant and squadron leader around to command all the squadrons. And you infrequently had squadrons being commanded by junior officers until the senior officers came along. So the expansion was, you had the impression, although I wasn't in any of the squadrons at the time, you got the impression that there was rapid expansion without there being sufficiently trained flight commands and squadron commands available. Because it must be remembered that they had to be converted to these new type aeroplanes, which were monoplanes like Blenheims and Wellingtons, and this couldn't be done overnight, so there was some short delay before these officers came available to take their proper jobs in the squadrons, these flight attendants and squadron leaders.
What type of impression amongst the officers and men did the coming of these new planes, the new monoplanes, create?
It was a great fillip to their morale, the transfer from biplanes to these monoplanes, but they had their problems in that not only were they new to the pilots, but they were also new to the maintenance crews. And I think they had their teething troubles in getting to know the aeroplanes just as much as the pilots had. So, as far as I remember, the accident rate was above normal, put it that way. It was higher than it should be, probably because of those two factors. However, by 1939, things were in much better shape. And, for example, the 82 Squadron, which got a photograph of 82 Squadron here in front of me, and it is really, they've got a full complement of airmen, trained airmen, and I think they still haven't got their squadron leader CO, still waiting for him. The senior man there is Flight Attendant Joe Hunt, whom I know very well, is now dead. He commanded the squadron at that time, when it's a squadron leader's job. So that goes to substantiate what I just said.
Was there any regret for the passing away of the biplane?
Not as a flying machine, but as an operational aircraft. There was certainly no regret, because by that time we were seeing the foreign air forces concentrating on monoplanes, particularly the German Air Force, which had been fighting in Spain, gaining operational experience. And there was heavy pressure on to get these monoplanes into service, particularly the fighters. And that carried on right away through. Impression one got that the pressure wasn't sufficiently high, and later on, of course, when Lord Briefer came into power, the Ministry of Aircraft Production, after the war had started, he changed things considerably and got pressure, real hard pressure put on.
Mm.
You said that you had this job of in 1939 of ferrying Blenheims to Iraq.
Mm. How was that job carried out?
Well, there was a... It was whilst I was at Coastal Command headquarters, Leon Solent. They asked for volunteers. And it meant doing a short conversion course onto these Blenheims, which I did at a nearby airfield to get its name. It's near Tangmere. We used to fly over there every day into our circuits and landings, getting to know this short-nosed Blenheim. And then we had to do a fuel consumption test. And then we took off with a full crew for Marignan Airport in south of France, near Marseille. From there we went to Malta, Malta to Cairo, and Cairo to Habaneer in the Middle East, in Iraq. It took us 3 or 4 days to get there. As we took no risks, we had to make sure we went in flights of three. We came back and took another lot out. The whole operation took about a fortnight because we didn't have air transport back. I'd come back by ship across the Mediterranean, then by train to Calais.
So it took a fortnight to get three planes?
Yes. Mm.
What was the Blenheim like to fly?
The Blenheim was a nice airplane to fly, completely different to the others I'd flown. A, the cockpit isn't totally enclosed. You had variable pitch propellers. You had an undercarriage which came up into the wings. Attracted. It wasn't particularly fast. I think cruised about 160, 180. Flat out speed is about 270. But in its time, it was quite a presentable aeroplane for the job it had to do. But of course, it couldn't contend with the modern fighter, particularly when radar came into the field, so it got vulnerable in wartime to fighters, radar-controlled fighters. Going back the time when I'd left the Fleet Air Arm, I was posted to 15 Group Plymouth as officer in charge of peace staff personnel. One of my jobs was to look after a case of any people coming up for court-martial. And I remember one, as an airman at Calshot, was being court-martialed for some Air Force offence. Everything had been arranged, the prosecuting counsel, defending counsel, the court-martial staff had been got together to take place at Calshot. And then came a crisis. I could not find the file dealing with the case. And without the file, of course, we couldn't proceed with the court-martial. In the end, the file was completely lost. I couldn't find it anywhere. The day the court-martial was drawing near, I'd been quizzed right, left and centre. I still couldn't find the file. The office turned upside down. No file. Then the court-martial day came. The man had no case. There was no case against him because he couldn't get all the evidence required. A fortnight after this, our office was being spring cleaned, the furniture being moved around. When they moved the filing cabinet, they found this file dropped down the back of the filing cabinet.
So the chap got off scot-free?
So the man got off completely scot-free, and I took the first opportunity getting out of this horrible job by applying to join number 2 group, which was flying Blenheims. This was because I'd flown some Blenheims out to Iraq and I was competent on the type, so I wanted to get back to flying. This is the only way of doing it. not by losing a court-martial file, of course, but that helped me on my way. Talking of court-martials, a very interesting one happened in 1933 when I was at Gosport doing the torpedo training flight. We did our torpedo dropping in an area in the Solent, just opposite, between Cowes and Leon Solent. And one day, the French liner Normandy came into this area and dropped her anchor whilst she was loading her cars. One of the pupils on the course saw this ship, and I think discretion took the better part of valour, or other way round, and he decided to fly his aeroplane down the side of the ship. I think he was obviously showing off, waving to all the girls on the deck, who were obviously waving back to him. He failed to see a cable from a crane on the starboard side, on the end of which was a large American Cadillac car. The net result was that he ran into the cable, cut it, the car went to the bottom of the Solent, and his aeroplane was swung around and landed on the forepeak of the Normandy. At this moment, the captain of the Normandy had just raised his anchor. He didn't stop and steamed off to Cherbourg with this Blackburn Ripon stuck on the front of his ship. The result was a court-martial, the result of which I forget. I think he got reprimanded or something like that. With the sort of unexpected thing that might happen to anybody in the Solent, flying around dropping torpedoes on that particular day. Another amusing incident occurred. I can't vouch for the truth of this, but this is how the story goes. A young naval officer was flying his flycatcher from Gosport to Lucas, and he found some form of trouble halfway. I think he ran out of petrol for some reason or other. He couldn't have had his tank filled up before he started. Anyway, he landed on the Great North Road, and there happened to be a garage handy, so he got hold of the garage mechanic and asked him to fill up with petrol. He put about 20 gallons in, which the young man paid, and then came the problem of starting the aeroplane. With it had no inertia or electric starter, and you could only start it by swinging the prop. The mechanic didn't know how to swing the prop, so the young pilot decided to put the mechanic in the cockpit and told him to hold on to throttle but not under any circumstances move it, and to put the switches up when he said so to make contact. Whereupon he climbs out of the aeroplane, the pilot having instructed the mechanic, and swings the propeller. The engine fires, mechanic loses his head, opens the throttle and roars off down the road. Whereupon he landed, the aeroplane turned left smartly into a ditch and was wrecked. I never heard what happened to him, the pilot of this aircraft, but I suspect he was dealt with without a court-martial, because in those days you could get away with almost murder flying aeroplanes. When I was in 811 Squadron, we had to fly back from Donnybristol to Gosport one day. The weather wasn't too bright, and there was a threat of fog. Naturally, if there was fog around, we couldn't do anything about it. We certainly couldn't land in it. So then the only thing to do was to make a forced landing somewhere and spend the night and go on the next day after the weather cleared. On the way from Lucas to Gosport, flying a Swordfish, I had two in the back, a young marine officer and a sailor, and I was in the airman, the RAF officer in the front seat, so had virtually three services in the airplane. We were flying down and we ran into fog in Wiltshire. It's highly likely the fog has spread all along the south coast, so the only thing to do, it was getting towards dusk, was to land. We didn't know what the weather was like behind us, whether it closed in or not, so we decided to land right away. So I chose a reasonable field, and we landed in this field and taxied up and switched off. It was a small village in Wiltshire, just outside the field. And very, very shortly afterwards, a large crowd came around. The village policeman came along on his bike and asked us what we were doing. I said I wanted a telephone so I could speak my base at Gosport, which I eventually did. So I told the squadron commander I decided to spend the night here and go on the next morning. Well, we next had to look for accommodation, so we found accommodation in a local pub, and there was myself in Air Force uniform, a Royal Marine officer, and a sailor with the ordinary sailor's hat on. TAG, he was. So we all spent the night in this pub. Needless to say, we had some fun with the locals who challenged us at darts, but we managed to beat them. So a good time was had, but all retired to bed and got up in the morning, early hour, to find a lovely day. Then, of course, we had to take off. We had what they call a Kaufman starter on a swordfish in those days, and so there was no problem starting up. The problem was really to get off. The field was small, it sloped downhill, but unfortunately the wind was behind us when it should have been ahead of us. However, we said goodbye to the locals, climbed aboard, put on the brakes, full throttle, down the hill, and just managed to scrape off over the hedge at the bottom and got back to base safely. No problem there.